thumbnail record of Abraham's other family. This is a part of Abraham's life that's almost never mentioned, just because it doesn't seem to have had a huge impact on the world scene or on redemptive history. But in the first, in verse chapter 25, verse 1, we're told that Abraham took another wife. I mean, Sarah had died sometime before. He took another wife whose name was Keturah. Now, in verse 6, she's referred to as his concubine. In 1 Chronicles 32, she is also, and that's caused some confusion. But we'll say first that he married Keturah. Her identity is debated. There's not any other information provided about her. She is essentially unknown. We have her name, and that's it. It has been suggested, because of a few details that are here, that Keturah may be a Hebrew name given to the Egyptian handmaid named Hagar, and that Abraham and she reunited at some time in the future. That's pretty speculative. The details supporting that are really thin. For instance, at Ishmael's death, his brothers are mentioned, and so that may support that interpretation. But they would still be his half brothers, regardless, right? That's kind of a stretch. There's a couple of little details that make that plausible, but there's nothing that necessarily indicates its accuracy. Anyway, it would perhaps explain why she is not only called his wife here, but also has been called his concubine in a couple of places. So those are basically the only reasons for making that guess. I'm not inclined to accept that identification of her, but I mentioned it because some may see that somewhere, and I thought I'd inform you that I'm at least aware of that speculative solution to her identity, but we don't know anything else about her. And through her, he fathered six more sons. Verses 2 through 6 says she bore to him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Shua. Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan, and the sons of Dedan were Ashurim and Latushim and Leumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher and Hanak and Abida and Eldaa. All these were sons of Keturah. So she's given him six more sons. Honestly, their names probably meant more to the Israelites of Moses' day as he's putting this record together than they do to us today, because most of those names have been lost to history. This is the only time they show up. More important to our study is that Abraham tells us Abraham provided for them adequately. Now, Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac, but to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living. And concubines being plural, I think, implies that she's not the same as Hagar, but that Hagar is kind of wrapped up in this statement, and Ishmael would be included. But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living and sent them away from his son Isaac eastward to the land of the east. These are all the years of Abraham's life, and he lived 175 years. So he provided for them adequately. He gave them gifts while he was still living. Nevertheless, the most important fact in that statement, in these verses, is that Abraham very explicitly excluded them from Isaac's inheritance. Isaac is still his only heir. Isaac will inherit his entire estate. Ishmael was excluded some years before. Now the sons of Keturah are mentioned as having also been excluded. They're not going to take a share of it. See, in general, a birthright was considered a double portion of what was going to everybody else. And so if you've got eight sons, you divide the estate nine ways. The one with the birthright gets 2/9, and everybody else gets 1/9. All right, he gets a double portion. If you only got two sons, it's 2/3. And that would have been what a birthright represents. That's not what's happening here. Abraham gave them gifts and sent them away, and specifically and explicitly disinherited them. They were not going to get any of his estate. It was all going to Isaac. And so this text makes that clear, that that's exactly what happened and on purpose. To avoid any conflict, whenever Abraham would pass from this life, he sent them away before he died. As he had done with Ishmael, he did with these sons also. They're adults. He expected them to make their own way in the world. It's like a parent today who tells their 30-year-old son, get out and get a job, okay? Make your own way. My parents told me that younger than 30. Okay. I wasn't even 18 yet when I left for college, and I never lived at home for more than a month or two after that. All right. They were adults. They were expected to go out and make their own way, and he's kicking them out of the nest, as it were. And we don't know how old they were, but we do know they were adults and that they would need to make their own way. It's been very difficult to identify his descendants archaeologically with any certainty, who these guys were, their names. There's only one of the names that does show up in the record, and we're pretty sure it relates to this son, the one named Midian. There's a group known as the Midianites that will later on, not much later actually, be associated with the descendants of Ishmael. You remember the story, we haven't gotten there yet because it's still a couple generations ahead, but Jacob's 11th son, Joseph, was hated by his brothers because he was his daddy's favorite, and they decided to kill him, but Judah talked him into selling him as a slave. And they sold him to a group of Midianites who were traveling through, and they were associated with Ishmael, all right? They took him then down to Egypt and sold him there. They were slave traders headed to Egypt. And that's in chapter 37, verses 28 and following. Later on, during the wilderness wandering of Israel, some 500 years after that, in Numbers 25 and in Numbers chapter 31, the people of Israel will deal with the Midianites again. They'll do battle with the Midianites. At that point, the Midianites are associated with the Moabites. Now, Moab was the son of Lot, by one of his daughters. And we remember that sordid story if we back up to Genesis chapter 19. The Midianites at that point in history, or at that event at least in history, are associated with the Moabites. Still later, the Midianites are going to be associated with the Amalekites, and they'll be the enemies of Israel, from whom God will deliver them through the hand of one of the best known of the judges, Gideon. All right? It's the Midianites that will be defeated by Gideon and his agency in Judges chapter 6 and 7. He's the only one of Keturah's sons who we hear about at all, of her descendants that we hear anything about. And we've got a list here of actually a couple of generations as well. The son's offspring for a generation or two there. Essentially, the general consensus is that the sons of Keturah and their progeny are ultimately all absorbed into the general people group called the Arabs. They're absorbed into the Arabic people groups. Today we'd probably call them Palestinians because the Palestinians aren't really a people. It's just a region of the world from which they have a heritage. All right. And then Abraham's death in verses 7 through 11. Abraham's death, it occurs when he's at the age of 175. Verses 7 and 8. It says, these are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man, satisfied with life, and he was gathered to his people. He was ready to go. He had accomplished what God had sent him to do, produced offspring that would be the fulfillment of God's, through whom God will fulfill his promises. And it says he was gathered to his people at the age of 175. Now, remember, Isaac was born. Remember how old he was when Isaac was born, right? He was 100 years old. He was an old man at the time of Isaac's birth. So at this point in history, if he's 175 when he dies, Isaac is 75 years old. Isaac was 40 when he took, we'll find that out. It's not mentioned, it wasn't mentioned yet, but he was 40 when he married Rebecca. At the end of the last chapter. And she will be barren for 20 years before she has children. This chapter will go on to explain. and she'll have twin sons, Jacob and Esau. And so Jacob and Esau will be born when Isaac is 60 or 61 years old, probably about close to 61 years old. But Isaac is 75 at this time. This makes Jacob and Esau 14 or 15 years old at the time Grandpa Abraham died. Okay, so they would have been there. In fact, they were considered adults because they hadn't invented the idea of adolescence yet. You're either a child or you're an adult. And that transition happened at age 13. He became accountable under the law at age 13 for them. And that's actually written into the law by the time Moses comes around. So they're adults, and at least young adults anyway, and have a lot of responsibilities when they were 14 or 15 when Abraham dies. I'll say more about that in a second. But what we have here, too, is the first time in Scripture that we find the expression, he was gathered to his people. First time. Others have died, but only for Abraham, it's the first time this phrase is used. It cannot refer to his burial for two reasons. For one thing, this statement is made in connection with his death, not with his burial. The burial is about to be described. And it's not describing the burial. But for another reason, when he is buried, we will find that he is buried in the same grave that he had purchased, this cave at Machpelah, for a burial site for his wife Sarah, and she's the only other one there. His people, as it were, are all buried in Mesopotamia, 550-some miles away, or Ur of the Chaldees, where they lived even before they moved, for generations before they moved up into Mesopotamia. So if it's referring to his burial, it can't be, because he wasn't buried among his people. He was buried with his wife, but that's not plural, right? So when it says he was gathered to his people, as far as I can tell, it cannot mean anything but an affirmation that there is life beyond the grave. That when he died, he was welcomed home. The Jews will come to call that place Abraham's bosom, as they longed to be gathered to their people, Abraham, their forefather, and their people who had gone on before them. Frankly, I find that a very encouraging and precious expression of the reunion that a believer can anticipate with believing loved ones who have gone on before. The separation is temporary. The reunion's permanent. And so Abraham had been separate from Sarah for a while, since she had died at the age of 137, the only woman in the Bible whose age at time of her death is recorded. And she was 10 years younger than Abraham. So she's been dead for about 30 years. And at the time of Abraham's death, but he was gathered to his people and welcomed home. His body was then consigned to the earth to await the resurrection. In verses 9 and 10, we have that described. Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael, and it's important that they're working together, that Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Machpelah, in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth, or the Hittites, where Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. That's the parcel of land. I've got here in the outline, buried at the cave of Machpelah, which is the parcel he had purchased for Sarah's burial. We should remember that from previous chapters. Also indicates it was handled, as I said here, handled by Isaac and Ishmael. That's important too. We don't know how much contact they've had prior to this, although we do find, we did note at the in the previous chapter, that when the servant came back from Mesopotamia with Rebekah to introduce her to Isaac to be his bride, Isaac had just returned from Beer Lahai-Roi. Beer Lahai-Roi was a spring that had been named by Ishmael's mother when she was expecting Ishmael, and she had met with God there, and God had sent her back. She had run away from Sarah, and God had sent her back. And she had obeyed. So that it's an area that is associated with Ishmael's habitation. And so he's apparently had contact with him. In fact, it's not just across the street to get to Beer Laharoi. The cave of Machpelah is described here as being at Mamre. The Oaks of Mamre, we already know, is the ancient name for the location that would later be called Hebron. Because Moses has provided that information to us. It's also Hebron. From that place, it's about 30 miles southwest to get to Beersheba, a well that Abraham had met with the Lord. It's about another 50 miles to the southwest beyond Beersheba to get to Beer Laharoi. It's about 80 miles. You know, you don't get in your go-kart and drive down there in an afternoon to cover the 80 miles. 80 miles on foot is going to take several days. Or on a donkey or on a camel, you can get there in a few days and back. But it's not an easy trip. And if you're there, you're there probably for more than an afternoon and probably for a purpose. And so that's where he had been. He had come back to Mamre and is where he meets Rebekah. And now we will see, too, that'll be important again in just a few minutes. but this was handled, Ishmael traveled home for Abraham's funeral. And they've apparently had some contact over the years, and they're going to have more contact beyond this, it seems. He showed up to honor his father. And he and Isaac were able to work together, apparently without conflict, in burying Abraham. And we're told that Isaac lived by Beer Laharoi, and it implies an ongoing friendly contact between them. The next verse states, I read through verse 10. Verse 11 says, it came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived by Beer Laharoi. I just told you that, but I hadn't read the verse yet. It's interesting that after the death of Abraham, it says God blessed his son Isaac. Now, I understand God had been blessing Isaac for a long time by this point. But I've stated in the outline, he began particularly bless Isaac. He's the next link in the line of the promised Messiah. It's not as if, you know, he'd never blessed him, but now with Abraham's death, the focus of God's blessing becomes Isaac. God's blessing had been focused upon Abraham, but now that he has died, because Isaac is his heir, and Isaac was designated by God as the child of promise through whom the ultimate promises of deliverance through a Messiah would come, that blessing now is focused upon Isaac. It's shifted to the next generation. We've already seen God blessing in the finding of a suitable bride. We'll find out in the next few verses, they've already produced the son that will continue the line, even though there's a little bit of confusion in the family about which of those sons that's going to be. But before going to that part of the story, it's kind of as if Moses says, oh, by the way, and speaking of Ishmael, and so he continues now, jumping ahead about another 50 years. In verses 12 to 18, we have the only record of Ishmael's family that's found in Scripture. God had promised Hagar in chapter 17, verse 20, that he would bless Ishmael, and Ishmael would be the father of 12 princes. Well, we find here that that was, in fact, what the record indicates, that Ishmael fathered 12 princes. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar, the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in the order of their birth: Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, Kedar and Abdeel and Mibsam and Mishma and Duma and Masa, Hadad and Tima, Jetur, Naphish, and Kidma. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. And so God had fulfilled his promise. 12 princes according to their tribes. It's going to be a generation later that Jacob will father 12 princes to become the fathers of the tribes of Israel. I think the point of the parallel, and even though it's going to be an extra generation before God does that through Jacob, the point of the parallel seems to be that while Isaac was the child of God's covenant with Abraham, especially for the spiritual blessing of producing humanity's Redeemer, there was a kind of parity in the way God treated Isaac and Ishmael in material blessing that he provided to them. So God first is talking here about Ishmael. We'll learn later about the sons of Jacob. And it jumps about 50 years ahead after Abraham's funeral when Ishmael dies at the age of 137 in verse 17. Now these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. And that's an interesting statement in itself, right? But he's 137 when he dies. Jacob and Esau, all right? Jacob and Esau, Ishmael's nephews, they're about 65 by now. And it's only about 5 years before Jacob will depart for Haran to find his own bride among his mother's family. I suspect that the death of Ishmael served as a kind of an emotional trigger for Isaac that eventually led to all the events that provoked Jacob's departure. Isaac and Ishmael were closer than we generally think, and that the death of Ishmael led to a lot of turmoil in Isaac's life that provoked things, the various events that will occur. We'll be looking at those as we go through the text. Take us a little while to get there. It's probably a little surprising, but I think it's important to note that the second time the expression he was gathered to his people was used refers to the death of Ishmael. If I'm correct in what it signifies, then that also means Ishmael was a believer. And we don't have any reason to doubt that. God had responded to his cry in the wilderness. He had made promises to Hagar. He had made promises to Abraham. Now, he did tell them that the sons, Ishmael and Isaac, would be at odds with one another, particularly generations down the road, that there would be conflict between them. And we know that that's been the source of all the conflicts in the Middle East today, is the conflict between Isaac and Ishmael that was predicted by God here. But that does not mean that Ishmael himself was not a believer. I suspect that we will meet him in heaven one day. Nothing is recorded concerning his burial. It says, he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, and they settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt as one goes toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. Now that phrase is translated quite differently in the King James. It says that he died in the presence of all his brethren. Again, that may mean that Isaac and the sons of Keturah were present at his death. But in the presence of is actually identical to another place that phrase shows up. The only other place that shows up in the Genesis account is in regard to Nimrod and his relationship with God. Nimrod was a famous rebel. He's the one who rebelled against God's instructions to scatter out and to settle after the flood, and instead organized and engineered the building of the Tower of Babel. And he was described as a mighty hunter in the face of God. All right, as it implies, is an expression that implies hostility. So the expression said in the presence of or in the face of probably should be understood as a hostile relationship, which is why the New American Standard and other English versions say that this was that he settled in defiance of his relatives. Letter C. He settled in defiance of his relatives. He did not want to go along with everybody else, and those the offspring of Ishmael and the family of Isaac. There was greater hostility between his children and Isaac than there had been between Ishmael and Isaac. All right, that's implied. And we see that having continued for millennia. All right. So the family seems to have broken off relations with Isaac and his family. And then at this point in Genesis, we get to the section. Actually, now we're getting to the section about which I wrote in quite a bit of detail in this book, Trusting God When Life Is Hard. Right. This was published by Bob Jones Press in 2009. It has recently gone out of print. If you go looking for a copy, if you've got a copy, it's a collector's item, right? Okay. They decided not to reprint it. It has the demand for the book has not been very strong for the last several years, and so they decided not to reprint it. I've got about a dozen copies, and I should be getting about 50 more here in about a month, about the end of February. But that'll be it until or unless I decide to self-publish a reprint of it. But anyway, it's in this book. I develop the life of the story of Jacob, taking a little different tack on what I think is going on there. I'll be covering a good bit of the material of that that's here in our study in Genesis. I'll be leaving out a lot of the documentation and a lot of the details and I'll also be covering some additional details in Genesis that weren't necessarily relevant to my purpose in this book as we go on forward. But I refer you to that, and I'll mention it from time to time as we go. Well, in the next section, we read of Isaac's twin sons. Isaac's twin sons in verses 19 to 34. Now, these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac. Isaac was 40 years old. That's where we find out how old he was when he married Rebekah. He was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean of Padanaram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. All right. So we've backed up 65 years from the death of Ishmael to while Isaac was evidently still living at Beer Lahairoi, about 80 miles southwest of the Oaks of Mamre, where Abraham and Sarah had lived and where Abraham will be buried but hasn't been buried yet, right? And they're going through a trial very similar to the one that Abraham and Sarah had endured when they first came into the land. God had promised that that he would give them a son, and they went 25 years without that promise being fulfilled. And here, Isaac and Rebekah have 20 years of barrenness. First two decades of their marriage, they are not seeing any evidence of a child coming along that's going to continue the promise. And God had made it very clear that there's going to have to be offspring. But they don't have any children yet. But finally, she conceived after 20 years and much prayer. They had been praying. She had been praying. Isaac had taken his supplication to God. The Lord responded by permitting Rebekah to conceive. The phrase that he prayed for his wife, in his commentary on Isaac and Jacob, Martin Sicker points out that the Hebrew phrase could be read more literally as opposite his wife, suggesting that they were praying together face to face, not in opposition to one another, but that they were praying together for this child. They were both praying for the will of the Lord. They both wanted the child to come and knew that the child had to come if God's promise to Abraham was going to be fulfilled. Apparently, the 20 years that have been passed in silence was a part of God's test of Isaac's faith. And to Isaac's credit, he did not make the mistake his father Abraham had made. He did not give up and say, well, this wife is barren, she's never going to bring the child, so I'll just take another wife. That's what Sarah had suggested for Abraham, and he had taken Hagar and produced Ishmael. And God said, no, that wasn't the plan. You were supposed to do what I told you to do, and Sarah would give you would bear the child. Well, Isaac never did that, and that's to his credit. He didn't follow in his father's follow his father's example in that. Now, she has conceived twins. That was not necessarily something that she knew immediately, right? They didn't do an ultrasound to detect two heartbeats, okay? That's not something she discovered right away. She found out there were twins when they were struggling in her womb with one another. The word has to do with, well, it implies wrestling. The verb actually, I've got here in the text, it says the boy struggled in her womb, verse 22. The children struggled together within her, and she said, if it is so, why then am I this way? And the this way is provided by the translators as an interpretive rendering of the verse. It may also mean, if this is so, why am I alive? Okay. Why do I even exist? If this is the way things are going to be. The word translated struggle is a very vigorous verb. It means literally to abuse or to crush. It's often linked with the word oppress. It's not the same word, but it's linked with the same word is used in the context of oppression in 1 Samuel 12:3 and in and 4 and in Hosea 5 verse 11 and in Amos chapter 4 verse 11. It was a difficult pregnancy, and it caused Rebecca a great deal of discomfort. It was causing her a great deal of distress. And the intensity of the conflict between the twins was fierce. She evidently understood the conflict in her womb as signifying lifelong contention between the two children that might endanger the fulfillment of God's promise. It might even imply, in her own mind, she was concerned, it might imply that one of the two children in her womb was trying to kill the other one before birth. That's how vigorous this contention was as they struggled together in her womb. Nevertheless, God came to her and said, two nations are in your womb and two peoples will be separated from your body. In verse 23, the Lord said to her, two nations are in your womb. One people will be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger. Well, that was both disappointing and encouraging, wasn't it? It confirmed her fears, but also gave her confidence. Yeah, the boys are going to be at each other's throats. There's going to be contention between them from now on. However, evidently, they will both survive delivery. Right? Isn't that implied by what he says? They're both going to have to be born alive and healthy. Now, we must not miss the fact that while Jacob and Esau are still what would today be called fetuses, the Bible refers to them as children, even as nations. But this is one of the biblical texts, one of several biblical texts, that present life as beginning at conception. Not at birth, but at conception. The Bible consistently teaches that a fetus is a person, created in God's image, possessing a soul. In this case, there are twins in Rebecca's womb that are distinguishable from one another and from their mother. The text is dealing with this situation as involving three distinct individuals, the mother and the two boys in the womb, right? I believe this alone should be enough to silence those who try to present abortion as a mother's exercise of control over her own body. My body, my choice, a favorite expression, right? You know, that's true as long as you're talking about your activities that might lead to a pregnancy. It was your choice, your body and your choice. But once a mother conceives, she has become a host to another person, another being, another body. And she has an obligation to care for that child. Which is why I believe the Bible presents abortion as the murder of an unborn child. And I think this is one of the texts that should be used to support that contention. Well, Rebecca turned directly to the Lord for help, and that she did so. The fact that Rebecca then turns to the Lord for help concerning this matter. If she, in verse 22, she said, if this be so, then why am I this way? And she went to inquire of the Lord. One of the things that tells us that even in this day, in this ancient period of time, with the patriarchal system in place, with the oldest male of the family being the head of the household, men and women alike both had direct access to God. She had the right to go to God and ask Him something. In fact, not only did she not need a human mediator, she didn't need to go to her husband to get him to ask God for her. She could talk to God herself. God answered her. He revealed to her His will in verse 23. I've already read it. One of the things that implies is Rebecca might have had a closer relationship with the Lord than Isaac did. There are several things that imply that as the story goes on. But here we get the first inkling that Rebecca probably had a closer relationship with the Lord than did Isaac. She's one of the very few women to whom God ever spoke directly. Can you think of another? It wasn't Mary. He spoke to Eve directly. Hannah, He communicated to her that she would have a son. What did you say? Okay. One you may not think of is Manoah, the mother of Samson. He spoke to her as the angel of the Lord, which I think was probably should be identified as Christ Himself. I'll have to look it up now that you mention it. But my point here is that here we have a very, very rare example of God speaking directly to someone. Even in the case of Mary, while God had a message for her, He sent Gabriel to deliver the message. And then after Gabriel delivered the message, when God communicated directly through a dream, He did so to Joseph, not to Mary. So in that regard, this is the only time, even though there were a couple of other times when God did speak to a woman, this is the only time in the biblical record God spoke verbally to a woman in answer to her prayer. Okay? It's the only time. Which makes this event pretty remarkable and noteworthy. God revealed to her His will. And what He revealed to her is that the younger would prevail. The younger would prevail. Now, the fact that the younger would prevail indicates, among other things, that the family's really not going to be peaceful and unified. There's going to be strife in the family. For one to prevail over another, and for it to be the younger prevailing over the elder, that implies strife and conflict. The birth is not going to resolve all the conflict going on in her womb at this point. Ultimately, they're actually going to be divided. That's implied in this. It indicates quite clearly that the second child to emerge from her womb would in fact receive the inheritance. The younger one would receive the inheritance. Now, he's not going to be younger by much, right? As twins, the difference in time of delivery is going to be very, very brief. As the story goes on, we'll find out just how brief, because he comes out hanging on to the foot of his brother. But what this means, what God has told Rebecca, is that the younger child and that child alone would be the heir of God's promise to Abraham and to Isaac. God was going to work through the younger of the two children. He's made that clear right here while they're still in her womb. Paul tells us in Romans chapter 9 that God did that on purpose before either boy had come out and done anything personally, so that it would be very clear that it wasn't based on their behavior that he made his choice. It was based on his sovereign right to choose. Romans chapter 9 builds that case. Now, at this point in history, the practice of what's called primogeniture was pretty well entrenched. It was assumed. It's later going to be established by law, in by the law of Moses. The firstborn son was expected to become the clan leader or the patriarch of the clan when the patriarch, the father, died. And he would have responsibility for leading family worship. He would have responsibility for maintaining the family property. And that's why he would receive a double portion of the estate as his inheritance unless the father designated it otherwise. The law will make provision in 1 Chronicles 5, 1 and 2. It's where we find that the law does in fact make provision for transfer of a birthright from the eldest son if a different son was deemed by the father to be more worthy. It wasn't required. It was presumed that it would go to the eldest son. But it was never required by the law. In the absence of a will saying otherwise, it was automatic. But a father could write a will that would say otherwise. It's interesting to follow the examples in the Messianic line of promise. If you look in the Messianic line leading to the birth of Jesus Christ, it often passed through someone who was obviously not the firstborn son. The very first generation after God told Adam and Eve that he would send one who would be the seed of the woman who would crush the head of the serpent in Genesis 3:15, it did not come through their first son. Their first son was Cain. It didn't come through Abel because Cain killed Abel. It comes through Seth, who was a later son. We don't know how much later. We generally assume third, but that's because we're not given all the names of all their children. They had lots of sons and daughters. The text tells us that. But he came through one who was definitely not the first or second born. He came through Seth. Skipping ahead, Noah, his children, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. The Messiah came through Shem. Japheth was the elder son. There was 2 years difference in their age. Moving a little further, at least one of Abraham's brothers, Haran and Nahor, was older than he. Possibly both of them were older than he. Isaac was the younger brother of Ishmael. Jacob's only a few minutes younger than, or a few seconds younger than his twin brother Esau. He's closer to the age of the firstborn than any other secondborn son in the line. All right? Because they were twins and they were born just seconds apart. If you move on down the line of promise will pass from Jacob to his fourthborn son, Judah, although the one who gets the birthright with a double portion will actually be his 11th-born son, Joseph. So that gets a little confusing. Much later, many generations later, when God's going to appoint a king and he's continuing to work through the line of Judah, Jesse's family is selected, and it's Jesse's 7th son, David, who would be the one to whom God would make further promises. From David, it'll pass through Solomon, who is his 2nd son by Bathsheba, after he already had other sons by other wives. As a matter of fact, as you trace the Messianic line, and there may have been many men in the Messianic line that were firstborn sons, but it's impossible to prove from the biblical record that anyone was a firstborn son before Jesus Christ himself. He's the only one specifically identified as a firstborn son. Not another one anywhere in the line is identified explicitly as a firstborn son. Now, there may have been several, but the only ones we actually know their birth order were all different than firstborn, all other than firstborn, which is really interesting. What that proves, what that teaches us, is that God always reserves the right to select for himself who the next one will be. Not necessarily according to birth order. He has always reserved the right to bless whomever he chooses. And he often extends that blessing to those who have no other claim to it and received what they did not deserve. And I'm stopping here in the outline. You can heave a sigh of relief. Because we would be here another 40 minutes or 45 minutes if I were to continue to develop this material. All right, so we'll pick up, not next week. Next week is the business meeting. But you can bring the outlines back, and I'll print some outlines that have some of this filled in to lead us up to here, so that if you forget your outline, you will have what you need to go on from there when we actually get back to this. I realized early on that I had overreached in trying to do that, to do all this. And I didn't want to hurry through any of this and not have time to really develop what I need to in the section that follows. Let's close. I'll tell you what. Let's take our hymnals and let's sing something first. Then we'll close in prayer. Number 454. The song title is familiar, but the music and text are a little different than what you think of. Higher Ground. There are two songs in our hymnal by that title. This is the one of more recent composition, published in 2008. Higher Ground, number 454. Let's stand together as we sing.